Okay, well, we're very delighted to welcome today Dr. Wen. On behalf of Dr. Okon, just to give a brief introduction, Dr. Wen is the director of the Center for Neuro-Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He's also the professor of neurology at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard Medical School. Dr. Wen's illustrious career is would require several hours to go over, but in brief, he's completed his medical education at the Medical College of San Bartholomew's Hospital, which is now part of Queen Mary in the University of London. He completed fellowship at Royal College of Physicians of the United Kingdom and training in the University of London before training as a neurologist at the Harvard Longwood Neurology Program, and has been since that time at Brigham and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Dr. Wen is well known as former president of the Society of Neuro-Oncology and one of the driving forces for building the specialty, recruiting members to the field, and educating several generations of future and present neuro-oncologists. He's a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal Society of Medicine, the American Academy of Neurology, and the American Neurological Association, member of other overseas institutions such as the BMA and the Society of Neuro-Oncology, and editor of the chief editor of the Neuro-Oncology Journal, which has many beautiful articles and great pictures and images advancing imaging care for glioma patients. His main research focus has been on novel treatments for brain tumors and optimizing response assessment and clinical trial endpoints in neuro-oncology. He's also a member of the steering committee of the Response Assessment and Neuro-Oncology Working Group. So with a warm welcome from the University of Florida, we're very delighted to have you here, Dr. Wen, and we're very much looking forward to your update on glioma. Thank you, sir. I think you have your microphone.
Sorry, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's a real pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you for the kind invitation. So what I'm going to... these are my disclosures. So what I'm going to try and do is talk to you about three things. In 2021, there was a new WHO classification of brain tumors that was published. And I'll mention that briefly, since as neurologists, whether you're interested in neuro-oncology or not, that is something that you should be aware of. Then I will briefly talk about the medical management of patients with brain tumors that, again, as general neurologists, it will be part of your normal work load. And then I'll spend the bulk of my talk talking about both standard therapies and novel therapies for both IDH mutated and IDH wild type gliomas. And then at the end, I'll spend a couple of minutes talking about novel designs. And please feel free to interrupt anytime if you have questions. So each year in the United States, there are about 80,000 primary brain tumors. About 25,000 of them are malignant, and most of them are gliomas. And about 13,000 patients each year have glioblastomas. So it's not as rare as some people think. And traditionally, astrocytomas, which make up the bulk of the gliomas, are graded based on their histology. From grade one tumors like pilocytic astrocytomas through to glioblastomas, which are grade four. But in 2016, for the first time, the WHO published an updated classification that incorporated molecular findings in addition to the histology. And in particular, it incorporated the use of the presence of the IDH mutation. And so That was in 2016. And then last year in November, the WHO published the 2021 classification of CNS tumors. And this has had a number of major implications, both for how we classify and diagnose these tumors, and also in terms of treatment. And hopefully by having a better classification, we can assign treatments better to patients, have a better understanding of the prognosis, and also put more homogeneous populations of patients into clinical trials. So one of the things that this new classification did was, for the first time, it separated out gliomas into adult types and pediatric types. And the pediatric groups are shown here. There's a group of four tumors that are low-grade gliomas. And then there are four subtypes of high-grade gliomas. So these are tumors that occur mainly in children, but can also occur in adults. And then for the adult tumors, this panel on the left were all the different types of gliomas in the last classification. And this has now been condensed to only three entities: astrocytoma, IDH mutant, oligodendroglioma, IDH mutant, and 1p19q co-deleted. So for both these groups, you have to have the IDH mutation. And then glioblastoma, which are IDH wild type. So these are the only three types of gliomas in adults now. Glioblastoma, these grade four tumors, until recently, was diagnosed based on the histologic finding of either pseudopalisading necrosis or microvascular proliferation. But when these tumors were diagnosed in that way, about 10% of these tumors had IDH mutations, and they had a much better prognosis than the tumors that were wild type for IDH. And so in the new classification, the IDH mutated glioblastomas are no longer called glioblastoma. These IDH mutated glioblastomas are now called astrocytoma IDH mutant grade 4. So this is a big step in separating out the two types of glioblastoma. So now a glioblastoma has to be IDH wild type. It can have the histologic findings of microvascular proliferation and necrosis. But in addition, there is a small subgroup of tumors that until recently, the pathologists would look at it and call it a grade 2 glioma or a grade 3 glioma. But it is IDH wild type. And when you do the molecular characterization, it has the molecular features of glioblastoma, and it has the prognosis and behavior of glioblastoma. And so these lower grade astrocytomas are now considered glioblastoma. So now a glioblastoma can either have the histologic features of glioblastoma, or it can have the molecular characteristics. And that these are one of three: a TERT promoter mutation, EGFR amplification, and gain of chromosome 7 or loss of chromosome 10. So if you have a lower grade glioma that's IDH wild type, and you have one of these three molecular features, you're now considered a molecular glioblastoma and treat it as if you are a glioblastoma. For astrocytomas, until recently, there was only grade 2 and 3 astrocytomas. And as I mentioned now, there is also a grade 4 astrocytoma. All of these tumors have to have the IDH mutation. When you look at these group of patients, those patients that have homozygous loss of CDKN2A do much worse. And so these tumors are also considered in grade 4. So histologically, they could look like a grade 2 or 3 tumor. But if you have CDKN2A loss, then you're automatically called a grade 4 astrocytoma. With oligodendrogliomas, These are tumors that are IDH mutated that have loss of 1p19q. And histologically, they have this fried egg appearance that you see on the right side. These tumors are, have to be IDH mutated. So you can see that in the new classification, the ability to determine whether your tumor is IDH mutated or not, and whether they have all these other molecular characteristics is really important. And so sequencing these tumors now becomes really important, but also adds to the delay in diagnosis. Until recently, when you look at a tumor, some tumors have components of astrocytoma and some have components of oligodendroglioma, and they would be called an oligoastrocytoma. But when you sequence the tumors, there's almost never such an entity that has both components. They're almost always either an astrocytoma or an oligodendroglioma. So going forward, you're not going to see the diagnosis of oligoastrocytoma very commonly. Now, in looking for the IDH mutation, in 90% of the cases, you can just do immunohistochemistry and you can detect the most common IDH mutation, IDHR132H. But in 10% of patients, they have non-canonical IDH mutations. And so you have to sequence them. And this, as I mentioned earlier, does take time and adds to costs. And it's actually very rare to find these non-canonical IDH mutations above the age of 55. So it's probably not economical to test for that in the older patient group. So that's all I'm going to say about the new classification of gliomas. But it's really changed our field tremendously, and we're still grappling with all the implications. But for neurologists in training, it's something you probably will need to know. It's the kind of thing that may come up in your board exam. Next, I'm going to... Are there any questions about this part? So I'm going to switch and talk very briefly about the management of brain tumors. So as you know, these tumors have a lot of peritumoral edema that contributes to the morbidity of these tumors. And the standard treatment is to treat them with dexamethasone. And the standard dosing is 10 milligram bolus, and then you give it to them 4 milligrams QID. And if nothing else that you take from this talk, hopefully you will not use this dosing of dexamethasone. The pharmacologic half-life of dexamethasone is fairly short, but the biologic half-life of dexamethasone is actually much longer. And you really don't have to give these medications four times a day. You can give it once or twice a day. You know, when Gleason introduced dexamethasone in 1961, it didn't come down on these tablets. I mean, still our neurosurgeons will have our patients wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning to take the last dose of dexamethasone. And you really only need to give it once or twice a day. You almost never need to give it four times a day. The other thing with dexamethasone is that in addition to all the side effects that you're well aware of, all the cushionoid problems, it may have an adverse effect on therapy and survival. So in these animal studies, animals with orthotopic glioblastomas given steroids with radiation therapy did worse in terms of prognosis. And in three different data sets, those patients who received dexamethasone had a worse outcome, even controlling for things like tumor size and the amount of edema. So we think that dexamethasone also has an adverse effect on outcome. And so when you have a patient with a brain tumor that's newly diagnosed, you should try to get them off as quickly as possible. And a common practice of keeping patients on steroids as they go into radiation therapy, just in case they might have edema, is not something that should be done. You should try to get rid of the steroids as soon as possible. Snow and Iano recently published updated guidelines on the use of anticonvulsants for brain tumor patients. Essentially, if you have a brain tumor and you've never had a seizure, there is really no evidence that prophylactic anticonvulsants are of benefit, and you should really take them off it 1 or 2 weeks after surgery. There's really not even good evidence that prophylactic anticonvulsants is useful for patients undergoing craniotomy. And so it's even acceptable not to use anticonvulsants in that situation. If you do use anticonvulsants, preferably you use the ones that do not induce the cytochrome P450 system, since it will reduce the likelihood of interacting with other drugs that may be used for the patient's cancer therapy and also may interact with protocol therapies. And there's no evidence that a particular anticonvulsant leads to better survival in any brain tumor patients. For a long time, it was thought that valproic acid might have a survival benefit, but that's really not true. Another common problem that we face in our patients is the development of venous thromboembolic disease. Glioblastomas create a hypercoagulable state, and about 20% or more of these patients will have venous thromboembolism. Old studies, such as the clot study from almost 20 years ago now, suggested that low molecular weight heparin is more effective than Coumadin in treating these patients. And so for many years, low molecular weight heparin was the standard of care for brain tumor patients with venous thromboembolism. As you know, more recently, there's a lot of interest in the use of direct oral anticoagulants. There's much less data for brain tumor patients, but in general, what studies there are, this is one, and there's another one that's about to be published, suggests that these agents are safe in brain tumor patients. And so increasingly, we're treating our patients with direct oral anticoagulants rather than low molecular weight heparin. So that's all I have to say about the medical management of these patients. I don't know if there are any questions about this part.
Yeah, Dr. Wen, there is a question from the audience. One of our neurocritical attendees was asking is how much steroid is tolerable for glioma patients? That's the first section. The second section says, would you extend the data regarding steroid affecting treatment efficacy to a patient who may need a few doses for a separate issue, airway edema, post-op, for example? And the third part is, would you extend this to primarily mineralocorticoid steroids, such as those used for adrenal insufficiency?
I think if they need it for other issues, you should definitely use it for what, you know, for the other indications. But for the peritumoral edema, as soon as you can get rid of it, the sooner the better. Even though the teaching is you give people 16 milligrams on day one, I almost never do that. I don't remember when I last did that. In patients who've not seen steroids, 2 or 4 milligrams is usually enough. If they have a lot of edema, I would use 8 milligrams, but I almost never use 16 milligrams. And sorry, I think if you need it for adrenal insufficiency, it's okay to use the steroids long-term. It's mainly talking about the high doses you need for the peritumoral edema that appears to be problematic. Are there any other questions about this first part? So I'm going to move on and talk about the treatments, both standard and novel treatments for gliomas. And there are a lot of recent reviews that address this, addressing both the high-grade and the wild-type tumors and the IDH-mutated tumors. And so for those of you who are less interested in neuro-oncology, I refer you to these references. And this would be a good time for you to catch up on your REM sleep. So I'm going to talk first about the IDH mutated gliomas. So these are the traditional grade 2 and 3 oligodendrogliomas, and now grade 2, 3, and 4 astrocytomas. So for grade 2 gliomas of both types, if the patient has a gross total resection, and if they're less than the age of 40, you can just observe them. You watch them closely and consider treatment only if they progress. Patients who are over the age of 40 or who have a subtotal resection are considered at higher risk. And in general, treatment is recommended for these types of patients. In the past few years, there have been a number of phase 3 studies that have been reported that have informed what we should do for these patients. So this study, published in the New England Journal a few years ago, suggests that the addition of the old PCV chemotherapy regimen to radiation therapy significantly improves survival in grade 2 gliomas. Now, when this study was conceived, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't know about IDH mutation. But when you break down those patients where you can determine the IDH status, the benefit is even more pronounced. So in the panel on the right, the top panel is on oligodendrogliomas. And you can see that there's significant improvement in survival with the addition of PCV chemotherapy. The panel in the middle are the astrocytomas, and there also you see benefit with PCV chemotherapy, although less than for oligodendrogliomas. And surprisingly, for the IDH wild-type tumors, which are basically the glioblastoma, in this study, there was actually no benefit of chemotherapy. For the grade 3 astrocytomas, there's been an important trial called the CATNON trial that shows that radiation therapy followed by a year of temozolomide chemotherapy significantly improves outcome. And so this is the standard of care for this type of tumor. What was unclear in the first interim analysis of this trial was whether giving temozolomide chemotherapy during radiation would also be helpful. So last year, they published a second interim analysis of this. And in the panel on the right, you see that the addition of temozolomide during radiation to IDH mutated tumors resulted in a modest prolongation in survival, but it wasn't significant. And so I think the general trend is to give these people radiation alone with a year of temozolomide afterwards, although occasionally some people will give it during radiation also, since it appears that there might be a slight benefit, although because of the small number of patients, it wasn't significant. For oligodendrogliomas, there have been two large phase 3 trials that shows that for these anaplastic oligodendrogliomas, the addition of PCV chemotherapy significantly improves survival. And so the issue in our field is that all these studies were done with the old PCV regimen, which is quite toxic. And for glioblastomas, for many years now, we've been using temozolomide, which is much better tolerated. And so the field is split between those who use temozolomide for these tumors and those who are sticking more rigorously to the published data and use of PCV chemotherapy. I tend to use temozolomide, and when I do use PCV, I don't use vincristine, since there's pretty good data that it doesn't really cross the blood-brain barrier. And this is not a drug that we would ever use nowadays. So to summarize, the treatment for lower grade gliomas, standard therapy for patients with gross total resection and who are 40 years or younger can be watched. Patients with subtotal resection or older than the age of 40 should probably be treated with radiation therapy and chemotherapy, and whether you use PCV or temozolomide is a matter of debate. Since the identification of the IDH mutations, there's been a lot of progress in developing novel therapies. IDH, as you may remember, converts isocitrate to alpha-ketoglutarate. In the presence of mutant IDH, the alpha-ketoglutarate is converted to an oncometabolite called 2-hydroxyglutarate that accumulates in millimolar concentrations in the tumor and causes epigenetic and genetic changes leading to tumorigenesis. And the hope is that if you can block the mutant IDH, you can reverse this process and produce a therapeutic effect. So we've worked on a number of trials looking at IDH inhibitors. This was the first IDH inhibitor, which is now approved for leukemia, called ivosidenib. And you can see that for those patients who have non-enhancing tumors, there's a lot of patients that are on stable disease, that develop stable disease. For those with enhancing tumors that are probably higher grade and more aggressive, the drug doesn't work as well. And it's likely that there are other molecular drivers in that group of patients. Because it's hard to tell if a slow-growing tumor is really stable on a drug, we did a lot of careful segmentation studies. And here you can see a patient with a small tumor area that's growing over time before they enter the trial. And then for the next 17 months, you can see that it's at least stable, if not slightly smaller. So we think what happens with patients on this type of treatment is that you don't get shrinkage of the tumor, but the tumor is growing, and then on treatment, the growth stabilizes. The same is true for vorasidenib, which was made specifically for brain tumors with a much better penetration across the blood-brain barrier. So after we did these two studies, we had two drugs that seemed to have activity: ivosidenib that we knew didn't get into the brain very well, and vorasidenib that was made to get into the brain much better. And so we did a surgical study where we gave patients with recurrent gliomas who needed surgery a month of either drug. And then we took out the tumor and measured drug concentration and the PD effect in terms of how much suppression there is of 2-hydroxyglutarate. And you can see here that ivosidenib, which we knew didn't get into the brain very well, had only a brain plasma ratio of 0.16. And vorasidenib, which was made to get into the brain very well, had a brain plasma ratio of 2.1. But ivosidenib is much better tolerated. So you can give at least 10 times as much of that drug. And so when you use the recommended phase 2 dose of both drugs, they both actually inhibited the pathways equally well. The first box is untreated tumor, and with both ivosidenib and vorasidenib, there is fairly good inhibition of the pathway. Ultimately, the company decided to go with vorasidenib, and there is a phase 3 trial for registration looking at this drug in newly diagnosed low-grade gliomas. And this trial has completed accrual, and we will have a readout in a couple of years, and hopefully it'll be positive. The advantage of these drugs is that they're very well tolerated. And if it keeps the patient's tumor stable, you can push off radiation therapy and chemotherapy and the attendant toxicities for as long as possible. There are a number of other novel therapies that are being looked at. In IDH-mutated tumors, there's a derangement of the DNA damage response pathway and decrease homologous recombination repair. It makes the tumors sensitive to PARP inhibitors, which, as you know, is approved for BRCA mutation, breast and ovarian cancer. And so there are a lot of trials with PARP inhibitors in IDH-mutated gliomas, either alone or with chemotherapy. There's interest in immunotherapy. A vaccine against IDH1 was published last year from Germany by Michael Platten and his group, showing that you can generate an immune response against these tumors and it was well tolerated. And a significant number of these patients had pseudoprogression, presumably due to inflammatory changes, suggesting a biologic effect. And then there's evidence also that when you have IDH-mutated tumors, the immune system in these tumors is suppressed because of the 2-HG. So you can imagine that you can inhibit 2-HG production with an IDH inhibitor, and then you can combine it with either a vaccine or a checkpoint inhibitor. And so these trials are planned or underway. So in a field where a few years ago we were just arguing about whether to use PCV chemotherapy or temozolomide chemotherapy, there's suddenly a lot of molecular targets, a lot of them I haven't mentioned. So this is really an exciting area of neuro-oncology. I'm going to switch and now talk about glioblastomas, but I didn't know if anybody had any quick questions about IDH-mutated gliomas. So glioblastomas is still by far the most common type of glioma and a tumor for which we have had very little progress, unfortunately. A lot of it has to do with the biology, but it also has to do with the difficulty of the tumor itself and a lot of issues that I'll talk about in a moment. But it also has to do with the neuro-oncology field really having to do a better job. This was a wonderful slide that Skip Grossman from Hopkins gave me, and it summarizes the behavior of neuro-oncologists like me. Supposed to be from American tribal wisdom. It says, when you discover you're riding a dead horse, the best strategy is to dismount. But many neuro-oncologists, including myself, will say that this horse is not really dead. This horse is no deader than other horses. We attend conferences like the Society for Neuro-Oncology to learn how to ride dead horses. Or we hitch several dead horses together to make them run faster, combination therapy. And I think as neuro-oncologists, we have to do a better job of identifying, retiring dead horses. So with glioblastomas, the first important step is maximum safe surgical resection. You really have to do a gross total resection to make a significant impact on the patient's outcome. And anything less than about 80% resection has no impact on survival. Surgeons have a number of techniques now to make surgery safer, including this 5-amino-levolinic acid, a porphyrin dye that lights up the tumor that allows them to do a better resection. And then standard therapy is 6 weeks of radiation therapy to 60 gray, together with daily temozolomide, followed by 6 months of adjuvant temozolomide. And with this treatment, the median survival is increased by 2.5 months, and 2-year survival is increased from about 10% to 27%. So it's a very modest benefit. And most of this benefit is in the 40% of patients with a methylated MGMT. The 60% of patients who have an unmethylated MGMT promoter, so the tumor has the DNA, has a repair enzyme, MGMT, temozolomide is essentially inactive. And this represents the majority of our patients, unfortunately. The other FDA-approved treatment for these tumors are tumor-treating fields. These electrodes placed in the head that produce low-intensity intermediate frequency current. And in a phase 3 trial, it led to a 4.9-month increase in median survival. And so this is also an FDA-approved treatment that some patients consider. With standard therapy, after a median of only 7 months, the tumors recur. And there are a number of approaches that can be used, but none of them really significantly improve survival. The most widely used treatment is bevacizumab. This is a humanized monoclonal antibody against VEGF. So it's very good at reducing peritumoral edema. And it's important because it improves the patient's quality of life and reduces the steroid use and the cushion on side effects, but it doesn't really have a significant impact on survival. Nonetheless, this is a drug that we use frequently for patients towards the end of their illness. For 20 plus years now, there's been significant interest in targeted therapies for these tumors, but the results until recently have been really poor. And this is despite the fact that our understanding of the molecular drivers of these tumors have increased significantly. And there are many reasons for that. There's the issue of the blood-brain barrier, this redundant signaling pathway, tumor heterogeneity, and an immunosuppressive immune environment. The tumor heterogeneity is a huge problem. Single-cell sequencing shows that even tumor cells in the same area can be different. And there's also a transformation between different cellular states. And there's also temporal heterogeneity. So some mutations, like the EGFR mutations, can be lost in the recurrent tumor up to 50% of the time. And so for some molecular targets, you really have to re-biopsy the patient to see if it's still there at recurrence. The blood-brain barrier is a huge problem. It excludes 90% or more of the universe of cancer drugs from being useful for brain tumors. And so increasingly, we have to do studies where we biopsy or do surgical resection of the patient's tumor to understand whether the drug gets into both the enhancing and non-enhancing areas. And if you have a drug that doesn't get into non-enhancing areas, it's probably not going to be very useful. I think as companies become more interested in brain metastases, they're developing drugs that are made to cross the blood-brain barrier better. And then there's also techniques like focused ultrasound and microbubbles that disrupt the blood-brain barrier for several hours that might also improve delivery. Despite all these problems, in the past year, there has been some progress. There are very rare tumors that have NTRK fusions that respond to NTRK inhibitors. We recently published the results of glioblastomas with BRAF V600E mutations, where there's a response rate of about 32% that's durable. And this is very different from the 5% response rate that we get with temozolomide. There are rare midline gliomas with H3K27M mutations. These are the mutations that give rise to diffuse intrinsic pontine gliomas in children. There's a drug called ONC201 that produces responses in a small subset of these patients. And even some of the older, more promiscuous multi-targeted kinases, such as regorafenib, have started to show some activity. And then there are some new molecular targets. There's increasing evidence that the growth of gliomas can be affected by neurons. Neurons produce neuroligin 3 that affects glioma growth. And this is cleaved from the neurons by ADAM10. So ADAM10 inhibitors might be a useful therapeutic tool. And then more recently, Michel Manji and other colleagues have shown that neurons make synapses with glioma cells through AMPA receptors. And as you know, perampanel, the seizure medicine, targets AMPA receptors. And at least in preclinical studies, has an anti-tumor effect. But this opens up a whole new class of agents that might be useful for treating gliomas. So for targeted therapies, there are now a small subset of glioblastomas that are amenable to these therapies, and there are novel targets that hold promise, but there's still significant problems with heterogeneity and the redundancy of pathways, and the blood-brain barrier remains a huge barrier. I'm going to touch on very briefly on immunotherapy, because as you know, there's huge interest in this in cancer. The problem in glioblastomas is that the immune environment is very suppressed. About 40% of these tumors have an immunosuppressive myeloid component. The tumors make immunosuppressive substances like interleukin-10. in the treatments we give our patients, the radiation and temozolomide and the steroids are all immunosuppressive. There's been a lot of work on different types of vaccine. Some of the earlier vaccines like rinderpepimut, which is an EGFR V3 vaccine, had no benefit. And in part because the V3 mutation is lost over time. And so this issue of antigen escape is a big problem. And so many of the newer vaccines target multiple antigens. One that is being developed at Dana-Farber using the platform that Kathy Wu developed is something called Neovax, and this is a trial led by my colleague David Reardon. Patients with glioblastomas have the tumor sequenced, and then they identify 10 to 20 neoantigens, makes a personalized vaccine. In a pilot study, they were able to show that these vaccines generated an immune response, but only in those patients who were not on dexamethasone. And now the study is ongoing, combining the vaccine with a PD-1 antibody. As you know, in other cancers, there has been tremendous interest in PD-1 blockade and other checkpoint inhibitors. And in rare glioblastomas with germline biallelic mismatch repair deficiency, where the tumors are very hypermutated, there are responses. But for regular glioblastomas, PD-1 antibodies, both for recurrent glioblastoma and for newly diagnosed glioblastoma, have been inactive. And it's becoming clear that glioblastomas are what's called cold tumors. There are very few T cells, and the immune environment is very suppressed. And so they don't have any of the characteristics that makes them likely to respond to checkpoint blockade. And so the current generation of trials is to try to convert these cold tumors into hot inflamed tumors that are more susceptible to checkpoint blockade. And there are a number of strategies to do this, combining vaccines, oncolytic viruses, targeted agents, and other strategies with checkpoint inhibitors. Another approach that we stumbled on was in a study we did in recurrent glioblastomas, just trying to understand what a PD-1 antibody did. So we took recurrent glioblastoma patients and treated half of them with a PD-1 antibody called pembrolizumab and half of them with no treatment, and then took them to surgery and looked at their immune response. And then afterwards, everybody got the PD-1 antibody. And we were able to show that even one dose of pembrolizumab increased the gamma interferon signature, decreased cell cycle genes, and produced patchy increase in inflammation. But what we didn't expect was that the patients who got the drug before surgery, this neoadjuvant treatment, lived much longer. Now, this is a small study, and it could be a fluke, and we're in the process of finalizing a validation cohort. But in other cancers, they've seen a benefit of this neoadjuvant approach in many other cancers. And the idea is that maybe there are a small number of T cells that are activated by the checkpoint inhibitor. And in glioblastoma, the removal of the main tumor mass and the immunosuppressive myeloid component might allow these T cells to expand and produce a therapeutic benefit. So there are a lot of these studies ongoing. Another area of tremendous interest are viral therapies. In the past, these therapies were given to kill the tumor and to introduce a suicide gene. But these viruses are also very irritating. So they can convert a cold tumor into a hot tumor. The Tocogen virus did not work, but there are a number of other viruses being tested. The best known, perhaps, is the poliovirus, where there appeared to be a subgroup of patients that had long-term benefit. We've worked with a herpes virus that Nino Chioka developed, and in some patients, direct injection of the virus into the tumor clearly produced responses. There's also a lot of interest in combining viruses with checkpoint inhibitors, and this was a study we did in newly diagnosed glioblastoma, combining an adeno the thymidine kinase virus with nivolumab, the PD-1 antibody, together with standard therapy. And there are other groups looking at the combination of virus with PD-1 blockade as well. And then the final immunotherapy I want to mention are CAR T cells. As you know, these are T cells that are taken from the patient and engineered to target specific antigens on the tumor cell. And for leukemia and lymphoma, the results have been amazing with potential cures. And a number of these are now FDA approved. CAR T cells have also been tried for glioblastoma. There was this famous case a few years ago where the patient with leptomeningeal spread of the glioblastoma was treated with an interleukin-13 receptor alpha 2 CAR T cell and had a major response that lasted for about 8 months. But in general, CAR T cells have not been as effective. This study with a CAR T cell against EGFRv3 showed that only a small number of CAR T cells actually went from the peripheral blood into the tumor. And there was a lot of upregulation of immunosuppressive factors in the brain following administration of the CAR T cell. So a newer generation of these CAR T cell therapies have used intratumoral delivery and a combination with PD-1 blockade. And there have been a newer generation of CAR T cells that target multiple antigens and also combine with other strategies to overcome the immunosuppressive tumor microenvironment. And so there are a lot of these CAR T cell trials that are ongoing. And I think as a field, things were kind of depressing until this past couple of months. Michelle Manji and Crystal Mackel from Stanford published this paper in Nature looking at a GD2 CAR T cell against those diffuse midline gliomas, which are in many ways the worst type of gliomas you can have that respond really to nothing except radiation. This study, they published their preliminary results on their first 4 patients, so it's still an early study, but they saw these dramatic responses in this patient with diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma and in this spinal cord tumor that again had a really amazing response. So I think CAR T cells are showing glimmers of promise, and there's still a lot more work to be done, but this is opens up a really hopeful chapter, I think, in the treatment of these gliomas. And then finally, the way we develop drugs is working very poorly. It takes so long to do trials for brain tumor patients. And so there are efforts underway to try to accelerate the way we do trials using these platform trials with Bayesian adaptive designs. The idea of these designs is that patients are randomized to different arms, and then the trial learns which arms are working better and enrolls more patients into the arms that are working better and fewer patients into arms that are not working as well, killing those arms off with fewer patients than you would need with standard trial designs. The first of this is a trial called Insight that we're running out of Dana-Farber. And then on a much larger scale is a global trial called GBM Agile that uses a very similar design that looked initially at 3 novel agents, and we're in the process of adding 2 other new agents to this trial. And so this is a trial that's being run in North America, Europe, and will be opening in China and Asia. And the idea is that we would plug in 8 new agents and just go through these, screen these agents and try to get FDA approval for them with about 1/3 of the costs and 1/3 of the patient numbers compared to standard trial designs. So to summarize, I think there has been some progress, but there are still important challenges to developing better treatments for our patients. And the issue of tumor heterogeneity and the blood-brain barrier is still a huge problem. There are some targeted therapies that are showing activity against rare subgroups of glioblastomas. And I think immunotherapies, and especially CAR T cell therapy, is showing glimmers of promise, and we still need to find a way to do better trials and to accrue better to our trials. But nonetheless, I think we're entering a much more hopeful era. My use of this drug has gone down in the past year or so, and it's not simply because in Massachusetts we have this that's now legalized. So I just want to finish by thanking the clinical trials group at Dana-Farber, who were involved in many of the trials that I mentioned. So thank you so much for having me. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Wen. We appreciate your time and detailed overview of the current landscape. And any questions from our audience?
Yes, I have one. Can you hear me okay, Patrick? This is Dwayne.
Oh, Dwayne, hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks so much for a great talk. I wonder if you might give us your insights into the thoughts behind use of bevacizumab as perhaps steroid sparing or in the context of immunotherapy trials for mitigating inflammation, and whether, you know, your experience and thoughts as to whether that's really helpful in that context, or how you are addressing the use of Bev and for that.
I think that's a really important issue. So the idea with immunotherapies, and especially some of the viral therapies, is that the therapy can cause inflammation. And normally you would treat it with steroids, but then that would suppress the immune response. So increasingly, a lot of trials allow patients to receive lowish doses of bevacizumab to reduce the inflammatory response and allow the patient to stay on study longer. And so I think that's an important new development in the field. And I think most trials should include that as an option. And I think right now, a lot of trials exclude patients once they've seen bevacizumab. And I think we should try to write trials not to exclude patients if they're using bevacizumab for this anti-inflammatory purpose.
Great, thank you. And maybe just an elaboration on that. Do you know if your surgeon's group is we've had some discussions also around the perioperative steroid usage, particularly again for patients that you're thinking about either neoadjuvant or just subsequent immunotherapy interventions, and whether they're moving away from that or being more conservative in that regard.
Yeah, as you know, that there was a study with a Xiaopharm virus, an adenovirus to make interleukin-12. And those patients who got very low doses of steroids in the perioperative and postoperative period did much better than patients who had a lot of steroids. So at our place, Nino Chioka does most of the virus studies, and he doesn't give patients steroids in the perioperative period. It's actually not much fun for the patient. They get a lot more headaches, but they, you know, if you explain it to them, they understand, and we try to give them pain meds instead. And so we're trying not to use steroids. I think it's something that hopefully will be more widely used, because it does negate any potential benefit.
Great, thank you. It's good to see you.
Dr. Wen, I had a question about CAR T cell toxicity and your experience.
Yeah, I think, it's definitely an issue, especially for lymphoma and leukemia patients. And in Michelle Manji's trial, I mean, it's amazing because she was treating these kids with diffuse intrinsic pontine gliomas. And some of them, you know, had hydrocephalus and needed shunts. So they monitored them really well. I think if the CAR T cells work, you may well get these immunologic problems. Most of the brain glioblastoma CAR T cell trials didn't really have a lot of side effects. And it may be related to the fact that they're not that active.
The question I had was the IDH mutation. Is that something historically taken from pancreatic cancer model?
The IDH, it is not so much in pancreatic cancer. So I think the tumor that has the highest percentage of IDH mutation is actually brain tumors, but it's also in cholangiocarcinoma and I think chondrosarcoma and a couple of other tumors, and leukemia. Leukemia is where these drugs have been approved, and azacitidine and ivosidenib are approved for AML.
Thank you very much. Any questions from our audience across different disciplines? I don't see anything in the chat box, but thank you very much for taking the time to come and educate us on the update in glioma.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you,
Dr. Bye-bye.